looking at the early restoration movements before the Campbell movement and the Stone movement. And really the Stone movement started before the Campbell movement, and then of course finally these two movements merged, and they of course are the important movements. But we need to look at these early movements before we get into them. And so as we continue tonight, we are going of course to study the movement, the New England movement. And but before we get started, I want to correct a mispronunciation of a word. I mispronounced a very important name, and I just got it hung wrong in my mind, and I had it spelled right in my notes, but I'm capable of that kind of thing. It is Asbury and not Ashbury. I put a Ashbury, and it is really Asbury. The Asbury would be correct. I want to get that so whoever listens to these will know when they get to this tape that that was mispronounced on the other tape. And of course, he, Asbury, he of course was the head of the Methodist Church after it was formed. He was the superintendent. And as we learned, of course, O'Kelly very much opposed that kind of power and that kind of authority. And eventually, of course, he broke off, he and others, from the Methodist Church. They called themselves, as we studied last week, the Republican Methodists. Then finally, they took the name Christian. But we learned that O'Kelly never did give up sprinkling for baptism, even though there were those in this movement who did come to the knowledge of the truth, recognizing that sprinkling was not right, but at least the act of baptism was immersion. And what we're seeing is just a slow working out of error, and it took a long time. Now, in our lesson last week, we talked about the difference between the Reformation movement and the Restoration movement. And we pointed out, of course, in the Reformation, they were simply trying to reform the Roman Catholic Church. Now, they failed in their efforts, and in their efforts to reform, they started churches themselves. And this is where denominationalism comes from, out of the Reformation movement. The major denominations, old line denominations that we're familiar with, like as we've already discussed, the Methodist, the Episcopalian, we didn't get to the Baptist, but the Baptists and the Presbyterian, all of them came out of what we know as the Reformation movement. Now, the Restoration, of course, is not trying to reform, but to restore, to go back and reject all of the authorities of Catholicism and all the authorities of Protestant denominationalism and creeds and things of this nature, and go back to the New Testament. And of course, you might say this really was the genius of the Restoration movement. They not only fought Catholicism, but they also fought the creeds and the authorities found in denominationalism. And so the last time we studied the efforts to restore the New Testament church, this was among the Methodist people. And of course, this effort was in Virginia and North Carolina. Now, in our lesson tonight, we want to study the idea of restoration as it was found among the Baptists in Vermont and in New Hampshire. We want to study what we might call the New England movement. Now, the second effort to restore, as we've already stated, was in New England. And this was started by some Baptist preachers in the very beginning of the 19th century. Now, this movement was largely associated with two young Baptist preachers, Elias Smith and Abner Jones, and they began their protest against Calvinism as it was taught now by the New England Baptist churches. Now you can see, to come out of denominationalism, you can see man after man was tired of Calvinism. And as he began to study his Bible, he began to see how contradictory Calvinism was to New Testament teaching. And I'll emphasize again, it's a shame that we've come to the 20th century, fought all of these battles, and that we have gospel preachers in our ranks today that don't know what Calvinism is. And if we allow, brethren, we'd better mark this down. If we allow Calvinistic teaching to come back into the church, and if we allow its promotion, it will destroy the very foundations of salvation. And we'd better learn how important it is. We've got preachers who'd love to shut the mouths of men who are trying to expose and point out what's wrong with Calvinism. And if we don't see what's wrong with it, we'll be back exactly where they were in the Reformation. The church could vanish. We talk about institutionalism destroying it. Well, you can destroy it from the standpoint of organization, but you can also destroy it from the standpoint of the plan of salvation. And these men, what we're seeing in this, all of these years of hard work to come back to what the knowledge of the truth was, just simply on the plan of salvation. What you and I recognize to be so simple, it took these men years of hard study to understand that a man has to hear, believe, repent, confess, and be baptized. And it took them a long time to understand that baptism was for the remission of sins. Even after they come to the knowledge of the truth that baptism was immersion, it took a long time before they finally began to realize that baptism was also for the forgiveness of sins. And so this is the reason we need to become acquainted with all of this, that we might see the dangers of denominationalism. And the devil, of course, he has his eras that he keeps bringing back in a new dress, same girl in a new dress, to try to destroy us. Now, let us first look at Elias Smith and his work. Now, Smith was born June the 17th, 1769, and he was born in Lyme, Connecticut. This is before, of course, the Revolutionary War. As we have pointed out before, the Revolutionary War started in 1775, and so you can see that he was just a little boy during the Revolutionary War. He was born to Irene and Stephen Smith. And Irene was the second wife of Stephen, and she was 13 years younger than he was. And when Elias was born, she was 19 years old. And she was a member of the New Light Congregationalist, and she believed in sprinkling. And so when Elias was born, naturally she had him sprinkled. And Stephen, her husband, was a Baptist. Now, the name Elias was given to him by his grandparents. He had an uncle that had been killed in the French-Indian War. And, of course, they wanted this grandson named after that son had been killed. Now, Smith never did like his name. He never did like the name that they'd tacked on him, of course, that had belonged to his uncle and his grandparents had given it to him. Now, as we pointed out, he was a child during the Revolutionary War. He was 6 years old when they fought the Battle of Bunker Hill. And, of course, he was able to hear and know what was going on. And Smith grew up to love freedom. I hope you can see in all of this that These men who became restorers, they were men who had great love for freedom. They just did not lack any kind of power that was going to suppress them. And you can see how this idea of freedom even had its working in their thinking when it came to religion. Now, he was a boy, of course, that was religiously inclined. He had a spelling book. And you wouldn't have this in a spelling book today, but it had a form of a prayer in it. And would take this spelling book, and he'd slip off to the barn, and he'd pray and weep. That gives you some kind of idea of the kind of young man he was. And in May of 1779, Smith, while he was living in Connecticut, he became greatly concerned about the subject of baptism. And he became convinced that in his intense study, that only believers were to be baptized, that they were the only subjects, and that baptism was the only method of baptism. Now, that may seem very insignificant to you and me, but in that day and time, some of this was some great learning for these people, a great advancement. All right? Okay, 1779. All right, and I said he was born in 69. Yeah. Okay, so I didn't catch those, but you know when you're dealing with somebody else's figures. So there's some kind of discrepancy here, but I don't know where it is. I didn't catch it. Sometimes I catch it. Sometimes you can figure it out, sometimes you can't. So, all right, glad you did. Y'all watch me. but I've tried to, I go back and check it. I have tried to be sure to try to write them down right, but you'll find that as historians record. Let's see, I believe, one we were studying the other day. I don't know where it was, O'Kelly or what, some of it. And you know, there was a big, maybe it was back in the Reformation period. All right. But anyway, whenever this occurred, he came to those convictions. All right. The Baptist Church in Woodstock, Connecticut, was holding its monthly meeting. And they had a preacher by the name of William Grohl was doing the preaching. So Smith went to Grohl, and he expressed his desire to be immersed. And he took him to the river, and he immersed him. And you stop to think about it. That was a little bit backward for Baptists, though. He finally became a member of the Baptist Church. But generally, what do Baptists want? They hadn't changed that much. All right, they want that confession of faith and given that experience, and then they're baptized. So he did it backwards. He got the preacher to baptize him. And then, of course, after he was baptized, he became a member of the Baptist Church, and he had to give his reason of hope. And he gave his consent to the Articles of Faith, and they voted on him, and he got in. But after he did all of this, he became a member of the Second Baptist Church in Woodstock. And of course, they still have their first and seconds, I guess. He was never sure about the Articles of Faith. You know, when they asked him, did he give consent to the Articles of Faith, he admitted later that he really didn't understand them, that he simply went along with them because the people and the preacher thought they were all right. Now you stop to think about how many times folks do that, many times even in the church. They're not careful. We'll go along with something that we don't understand. But later now, he rebelled against the articles of faith when he had time to really study them. When he began to see they were filled with deep Calvinism. And he opposed this. So in 1789, he began to think about becoming a preacher. And he became disgusted, though, as he began to listen to the Baptist preachers. He listened to several Baptist preachers, and he wasn't impressed with them at all. He thought they had very little ability. So he determined that if he made a preacher, the first thing, he'd have to be convinced that he had a call from God to be a preacher. And secondly, if he felt he had that call, he'd make preparation before he preached. And that's a great lesson all of us need to learn today from the latter end of it, to make preparation before we preach. Because when we begin to think sometimes that audience don't catch that we are without preparation, they do. And sometimes people become just as disgusted today as Smith did in his day, listening to the lack of preparation on the part of Baptist preachers. So he began to make an intense study of the Bible, and in November of that same year, William Grohl, the Baptist preacher who had baptized him, he gave him a book of sermons and Prudence Concordance. Now, I haven't checked the history of Prudence Concordance, but you can see it goes back a long way, the basic concordance that Prudence made. It was already in existence at this time. And so Smith gradually began to work toward becoming a preacher. And through intense study of the Bible, Smith came to the conclusion that the followers of Christ ought to wear the name Christian and only wear that name. In May of 1802, he was speaking in a man's house in Epping, New Hampshire, and on the text of Acts 11:26, and for the first time, now this is the first time he began to launch out and do this kind of preaching, and the history I was reading pointed out that he didn't he did it sort of softly when he began to do this kind of preaching, but he began to tell the people that the name Christian was enough for the followers of Christ without adding the words Methodist and Baptist and so on. So he began to make an attack, you can see, against the wearing of denominational names, not just emphasizing the positive, but also the negative end. These names ought not to be worn. And so he began to do that kind of preaching in 1802. Now, at this meeting, he also began to speak against catechisms and against the inventions of men, you see. He began to make an all-out attack on the forms of denominationalism. Now, his preaching on Calvinism and these matters, before long, they really brought him in disrepute among the Baptists of that day. And his reaction against Calvinism almost drove him into universalism. He almost went from one extreme to the other. In other words, universalism would be that everybody's going to be saved, if I understand universalism. Calvinism teaches that only a select few is going to be saved. So he nearly went from one extreme to the other. But his intensive study of the Scriptures prevented him from going to this extreme. And that ought to teach us something. Whenever you get confused, you begin to read something, the best thing you can do is lay that aside and get your Bible out and begin to see what the Lord says. And this is the thing that kept him from going at this time into universalism. Now, Smith gradually was convinced that the clergy was wrong. And of course, as you looked at denominationalism, they had the clergy and laity. They brought some of that right on out of denominationalism. And he was convinced that the clergy system was of their own invention and that it was contrary, of course, to what the New Testament taught. Now, when Smith saw all of this and ran into all of this opposition, none of this discouraged him. And, of course, that's what it takes. It takes courage and conviction to go on, because if you're going to try to do right, you're going to have a lot of discouragement. A lot of folks are going to be against you. And so at Portsmouth, New Hampshire, in October 1802, the friends of Elias Smith, they rented a hall called Jefferson Hall. It was over a market, and he and these friends began to hold regular meetings every Sunday morning. And Smith and his family, they moved here in December. Now, the hall burned down at December the 26th, and they, of course, were without a meeting place. And when this happened, there were only 5 members. So they began meeting in the school building. Sounds like folks today. This group, they were determined to follow the New Testament order and to wear the name Christian without any sectarian names added. And so you can see this great desire, these people to get back to the name Christian, to get rid of sectarianism. The 1st of March, their number had increased to 10. And Smith said, when our number was short of 20, we agreed to consider ourselves a Church of Christ, owning Him as our Master, Lord, and Lawgiver, and we agreed to consider ourselves Christians without the addition of any unscriptural name. So this gives you some idea of the kind of progress they were making. Now the group, it grew, and the last of March, 1803, they were meeting in the courthouse, and on the first Sunday in April, they held their first communion service, and by now they had 22 members. And then 1 year later, there were 150 members. So you see, this group really began to catch on and take off from the standpoint of growth. What they were preaching was attractive to people of that day. By this time, they had purchased them a lot and a building. In 1803, in June, Abner Smith from Vermont. Now, he didn't know anything about Abner Jones, rather. Excuse me, we're talking about Elias Smith. Abner Jones from Vermont visited Smith. Now, Smith didn't know anything about Jones. He didn't know what Jones was doing, but Jones was over in Vermont coming to some of the same conclusions. In fact, after the visit, Smith said really he was further along in some of his thinking than he himself was. And he said after he met Jones that he was the first free man he had ever seen. And Smith then, as I've already pointed out, he admitted that Jones was far beyond him in his thinking. So this visit from Jones, it really did help Smith, because you can imagine if you were thinking or if you were trying to carry a battle along alone, and you thought you had no help, and you thought probably you were the only fella in the world that held these views, and then you can think about running up on somebody else that had the same views and how encouraging that would be. And so it was very encouraging. Now let's look at Jones. Let's look at Abner Jones. Jones, he was born in Massachusetts on, I didn't put the month down. I guess I had it and I failed to, but I'll give you the year. He was born in 1772. When he was 8 years old, his parents, they moved to Virginia. And until Jones was 20 years of age, he lived a very irreligious life. And for a time, he had taught school. But in the spring of 1793, he was converted, of course, converted to the Baptists, and baptized in the Baptist church. And then, after his conversion, he began to preach. And he began to be very much concerned about what to preach. And that's a pretty good thing for a fellow to think about if he's going to preach. So he began to study his Bible to find out what to preach. So that was the right place to go. Jones soon discovered that Calvinism, and I want you to notice, man after man, when he read his Bible, began to see that Calvinism was wrong. And they learned it from studying the Bible. It makes us wonder about folks today who claim to be gospel preachers and are taken up with Calvinism. I think they need to do more like old Brother Puckett used to say back in the early 70s before he died. One of our great problems today, preachers are not reading their Bibles enough. And members of the church are not either. But these men began to see what was wrong with Calvinism by reading the Bible. And he began to see that Calvinism was unscriptural. And the Baptist church, they began to look upon Jones very coolly. In other words, they really began to give Jones the cold shoulder. So Abner Jones, he had studied medicine. And he, of course, was qualified to practice medicine. And he began to practice in Linden, Vermont in 1797 or 1798, somewhere along in there, he set up a practice. And about this time, he married. And he made this his permanent home. But about this time, a revival took place. And I'm using, of course, their language, you understand, in the city. And he began to think about preaching. It really got him stirred up. And so he stopped his practice of medicine and went into preaching entirely. In 1801, in the fall, he organized what he called a free church in Linden, Vermont, which rejected human names, and the members insisted solely upon the name Christian. So you can see the great emphasis of all of these restorers to get rid of human names. That's one of the first things they really come to a knowledge of. We've got to get rid of these sectarian names. In 1802, he organized churches in Hanover and I'll give you the spelling. P-I-E-R-M-O-N-T, New Hampshire. So he established two congregations. After he and Smith met, after this, they continuously worked together in establishing what they call free churches in New England. And to give you some idea of the work they did, one of their supporters in New England reported in 1827, he said he had found nearly 100 companies of free brethren. I understand by that terminology 100 churches. Free brethren that meet together to worship God in the name of Christ without any sectarian name connected with it, without any sectarian creeds, articles, or confessions, discipline to illuminate the Scriptures. It is our design to remain free from all human laws, confederations, and unscriptural combinations, and to stand fast in the liberty wherewith Christ hath made us free. So that gives you some idea of the feeling of these people at this period of time and how far along they had come. But I took this out of some of Ed Harrell's writings, and Ed says by 1830, the independent congregations could be found as far west as Ohio. So you can see how they, of course, were reaching out. Now, Smith, on September the 1st, 1808, we're going back to Smith now. Of course, Smith and Jones have been working together. You've seen after they've met up with each other. But Smith now, in 1808, he begins to publish a paper. He came out at this date that I gave with his first issue. He called it Herald of Gospel Liberty. You can see they love that word liberty. In other words, they used that word liberty. It was a fascinating word to them at that day and time, or in that day and time, as they had just come out of the Revolutionary War. And any time they could apply the word liberty and have some advantage with it, whether it was in religion or how, they used it, you see. Now, this paper was, he points out, the purpose of it was to announce the liberty of man from the bondage of creedalism and sin. So, you see, they were trying to get rid of and get away from creeds. Now, Smith had a lot of financial difficulty with his paper, and that's the history of papers. If you think that brethren make money with papers, let me tell you, they don't. They never have. Through the Restoration Movement, it's a struggle to keep them things going. And fellows like Connie Adams who struggle with them, they are to be admired. It's nothing but a lot of headache and a lot of hard work to try to keep those things going. So don't ever think that these fellows who are operating them are making any money. A lot of times, a lot of men have gone under. As I say, even from the early days of Restoration Movement, trying to operate papers. So, one time he was so hopelessly in debt, to free himself of the debt, he had to move. He had been in Portland, Maine once before, but he had to move back there to get himself out of debt. And in the spring of 1816, he moved to Boston and began to make appeals to his subscribers to send him money or else his paper was going to go under. And finally, in August 1817, he announced, and this is a sad thing, he announced that he was dropping his paper immediately if people didn't pay him what they owed him. And then in this period of time, he was having trouble with his own beliefs. Calvinism was bothering him again, and his misgivings about his belief. And as he began to, his problems with Calvinism, and at this time, it was gradually pushing him toward universalism. You remember back earlier, he had problems and almost went into universalism. Well, at this period of time, the last issue of his paper in October the 1st, 1817, when he published the last number, he said he had gone into universalism. Isn't that sad? Man makes all of these strides and all of this struggle. But what does that teach us? As it happened to them, it can what? Happen to us. And as you see men who have made great strides and fight for the truth, and then you see them, after fighting for years, take up with some false doctrine. Now, this man hadn't come out of false doctrine completely by any means, but the road he was on was right. And then to see him completely turn. Now, but while he published the Herald of Gospel Liberty, it served a good purpose, because during the period of time that he was publishing it, he was pointing men back to the New Testament. Now, there's no way to know, of course, and I'm not that good a historian to know the full impact that this movement had on others. We can just only presume just how much impact that this work they did when they did establish over 100 churches that were independent. They were trying to bring them back. Now, I know many of them went on into sectarianism, because these men, they never brought the people all the way back to the truth. If you want to get some idea of what their convictions were, I've tried to somewhat show you, but they held about the same type conviction that James O'Kelly and his followers had, but they never got all the way back to the truth. So the New England movement, it's significant in the fact that it was pointing men back in the right direction, pointing them back to the New Testament order of things and trying to get them to turn from sectarianism. Now, these men didn't go far enough. They were traveling, of course, an uncharted course, and they were having to think their way as they went, and it would take a lot of time to develop all of their thoughts to the fullest end of what the truth was. And so it remained for others to carry on from here. And we'll pick up a little now, and we want to introduce, I've got time, I want to introduce the Stone Movement and get started on that tonight. Now, when we get now to the first part of the 19th century, this movement we just got through talking about came on into the 19th century, the early part, and went on. But the two real significant movements in the 19th century was the Stone Movement and the Campbell Movement, Barton W. Stone and Alexander Campbell. Now, of the two men, Stone and Campbell, you know more probably about Campbell than you do Stone. because Campbell was more popular and more recognized than Stone, but Stone played an important part. And we'll get into some of that next week, but we owe a lot to Stone right here in Kentucky, because Stone did his work right here under our nose, all over this state. The churches here in the southern part of the state, old John Mulkey, if you are the old Mulkey meeting house down at Tompkinsville, of course, that goes back in the Restoration Movement. Mulkey, I found connection today in some of my reading. Mulkey, no doubt, had connection with Stone when he started the work in Monroe County. And a lot of these fellows who sprung up in different places, they went back to the seed that Stone had planted. As I pointed out, it's an interesting thing to study the counties that I was raised in and Brother Dave was raised in, Lauderdale County and Limestone County in North Alabama. The early men who went in there and established churches came out of Kentucky. They were men who had been converted under the Stone Movement. So the Stone Movement is a very significant movement, the work that was done. Now, both Stone and Campbell, they deserve outstanding credit for the move that they made to return to New Testament times. And all of us will have to admit that and give them proper credit for the work they did to help bring men out of the wilderness of denominationalism. Now, each one of them, as I've said, they made a valuable contribution. But when we begin to look at the early life of Barton W. Stone, he was born on Thursday, December the 24th, 1772. He was the son of John and Mary Stone. Now, the Stones lived near the town of Port Tobacco. Now, this was in the southern part of Maryland. His father died when he was 3 years old. In 1779, when Stone was 7 years old, his mother moved him and the other children over to what was known as the Dan River Country. This was on the border of North Carolina. Now, the Revolutionary War was going on at this time, and so young Stone, he, like the fellow we just studied, he had impressions made upon his mind about what was going on during this war. And he, like all the rest of them, he learned to love liberty. Liberty was the thing. Liberty played an important part in these men's thinking. Not only liberty in civil liberty and to have liberty in a nation, but liberty in religion. It affected their whole thinking, you can see. And so he loved liberty so, of course, this affected him from the standpoint that he hated the creeds of men. He hated anything that, of course, that took the liberty away that's in Christ Jesus, following the New Testament plan. Now, Stone's mother had him sprinkled when he was an infant because she was a member of the Church of England. Now, before the Revolutionary War, the Church of England, it was the church in Maryland, and it was supported with taxes. Then after the Revolutionary War, of course, them preachers didn't get paid no more, and we've already learned that during the war, most of them, they loaded up, went back to England, and that we learned that when we studied the Methodist movement, and they left these Methodist preachers, of course, where they couldn't perform weddings or preach funerals or anything of that nature because they hadn't been duly ordained, and we went through all of that. And it's an interesting thing, too. Whenever they fled back to England, that just left the people really what little spiritual guidance they were giving them. It left them without any spiritual guidance. It just left the church houses open. Later on, Methodists and Baptists and things came in and began to use those buildings, if I understand correctly, and places they were using, and began to preach. And this is one of the things, though, that disgusted Stone in his early days of about religion, when he began to see how the Episcopalians and the Baptists and Methodists, when he began to see how they fought among one another. It just disgusted him when he saw the infighting and the division. And so he really just gave up on religion. And he turned himself as a young man to worldly pleasure. Now we've learned when he was 3 years old, his father died. Now the estate of his father was settled in 1790. And he took his part of his father's estate, and he decided he had invested in education. So he takes his money and goes down into North Carolina, 30 miles southwest of his home, and he found a very famous school run by a Presbyterian preacher by the name of Caldwell. It would be like the Caldwells, you know, that preach today, pronounced the same way. Caldwell, he had built this school about 23 years before. It was a log building. He lived in the top of it and had his school in the bottom, on the ground floor. And whenever Stone entered the school, there was about 50 students enrolled. Now, he didn't go there to make a preacher. I know he was worldly in his thinking at this time. He went there to make a lawyer. That's what he had his heart set on. But Caldwell was a very educated man. He had been graduated from Princeton and was on up in years at the time Stone entered the school. Now, as I maybe hadn't pointed this out, but you've already guessed, this was a Presbyterian institution. And, of course, boys that came there, he tried to encourage them to make Presbyterian preachers. But there was a very outstanding, popular Presbyterian preacher by the name of James McGrady. He was come into that section and began to preach. At the time now, Stone was in school, and about 30 students religion. And that really disturbed Stone, because he really didn't much like that religious environment. He wanted to make a lawyer. He didn't want to get his mind on religion. He thought if he did, that would just cause him to lose interest in the goals that he had set. So he intended to leave Caldwell School, but when he got ready to leave, a big storm came up. He was going down in Virginia to go to school, and a storm came up. I believe it was the next day after he made his decision, and he couldn't go. And of course, McGrady, he was still preaching in the area, and so his roommate, Stone's roommate, persuaded him to go hear this preacher preach. And so when he heard him preach, why, he urged sinners to flee the wrath to come, and to do it, and to come, of course, without delay, to get their lives corrected. And so this kindled again in stone interest in religion and in his own salvation. And so for about a year he suffered long, it says, trying to get religion. And he just wasn't having any luck at all. And then there was a young preacher came through by the name of, or he went to hear a young preacher, by the name of William Hodge. And he heard him speak on the love of God toward sinners, and that Jesus had come to save the lost, and that him that cometh unto me, I will in no wise cast out. And when he heard that, then that's the thing that brought Stone into the Presbyterian Church. And when he became a member of the Presbyterian Church, he decided to preach. Then he left Caldwell School, and he went down into Georgia, and he began to teach. He was involved in teaching in a Methodist school down in Georgia. But he didn't stay too long in Georgia, and he came back to Virginia, and he just, Earl West, in some of the writings I read from him, he says he just sort of wandered around, not knowing what he wanted to do, whether he wanted to teach or preach. Finally, he took his examination and got his license to preach from the Orange Presbytery in North Carolina in 1796. And he then moved to Fort Criswell. This was over on the Virginia border, and he began to preach for the Presbyterian Church, but he preached about a month. This fort was a gateway between the East and the Badlands of the West. And every day there would be a big wagon train of people coming through going west. And so he got the fever. He was going to go west. So he began to travel with them. And so he reached the city of Nashville. He said, of course, there wasn't much to Nashville at that time. I forget his exact expression, but it's evident it was just some kind of little village that amounted to nothing at the time he came to Nashville. He stayed at Nashville a while, and then he went on from Nashville, or came on Nashville here to Kentucky, to Concord. Concord now is about 10 miles northeast of Cane Ridge. Many years I've been in Kentucky, I've never been to Cane Ridge, but I'm going to go if the Lord lets me live. And it would be interesting for all of us to go to Cane Ridge. And now, Cane Ridge is north of Lexington. Bob, have you been there? Yeah, okay, good. Okay. So this is where he come to. Now we've got him at Concord, and that's where we're going to leave him till next week. Because a lot of events take place, and so we will be ready to develop the Cane Ridge meeting and that whole thing and what can come out of that, and then his thinking and his being